Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. Last month, there was a series of investigative stories on NPR and PBS's Frontline about two major federal programs for low-income housing, the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program and Section 8 housing vouchers. I wanted to find out how those programs are faring in Syracuse and what other state and local programs are in place to help address the problem of quality housing for the poor and the problem of housing segregated by family income. I'll be spending two episodes exploring that topic with my two guests, Paul Driscoll and Stephanie Pasquale. Paul Driscoll is the city's commissioner of the Department of Neighborhood and Business Development, and Stephanie Pasquale is the department's deputy commissioner, focusing on neighborhood development in particular. Deputy commissioner and commissioner, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Grant.
Thanks for having us.
Paul, let me start with you. Can you just briefly explain to our listeners how these two federal programs work, the low-income housing tax credit program and Section 8 housing voucher? Just the basics. How do they work?
Sure. I'll start with the low-income housing tax credit. It was a creation of the 1986 tax reform that incentivizes private developers to rehabilitate or newly construct affordable housing. And it's an allotment based on the population of – it's a federal program, and it's they allot these tax credits based on state population. And the state actually determines who within the state gets awarded these tax credits. Mm-hmm. And tax credits are different from tax deductions in that it awards the developer – credits that they can sell to a bank that the bank can use to write off their tax liability when it comes April, but that the proceeds from that sale become the equity or the money to build or rehabilitate affordable housing.
And that makes it, in a sense, a good business proposition for the developer because they get that money, in a sense, up front from the government, although they sell it to the banks typically.
Correct.
Okay.
So, yeah, there's an incentive all the way down the line. Really quickly, housing choice vouchers were created by the federal government in the mid-70s, I think 74. And those are issued mainly to public housing authorities to administer. And they're portable vouchers that are issued to low-income households that they can take anywhere in the country, really, to a private landlord and say – what it does is the voucher looks at the household's individual income and limits their portion of the rent to 30% of their income. So if the so best put in an example is if the rent is $800 a month and 30% of that household's income works up to $400, or I should say $300, the other $500 is paid for through the voucher.
Mm. Now, I want to get into a discussion of some of the problems that this series of investigative programs and reports found with these two programs and whether those things have happened in the Syracuse area. But first, let's just see how these programs work here and how significant they are, because that was one of the things that I was curious about when I was listening to the programs on NPR and Frontline. Stephanie, can you give me some idea of how significant these two federal programs are in the city of Syracuse? Is there any kind of statistic on this or a general sense that we have about, you know, how much people in the city use these kinds of these two programs?
Sure. We had collected some information just over the last 5 years, and I believe it's north of 155 units in the low-income housing tax credit area have been developed. And typically those are projects, 50 units, 52 units in nature. For the most part, they're centrally located, although we have some developers that have been doing a more scattered site approach. Mm. But those units have been developed both from nonprofit developers and for-profit developers over the years, of which we participate sometimes with other federal funds, the Home Investment Partnership, to support those activities.
What about the Section 8 housing vouchers? Is there any idea of how prevalent those are in the city?
So I think it's worth noting there's the vouchers or travel with the family that you saw in the frontline piece.
Okay.
So the person you're seeking out privately held rental property, and that voucher travels with you as long as the property meets the housing quality standards set forth. The housing authority, though, also owns what they call their own housing, right, that is project-based. So the unit itself is affordable, the actual structure
right.
or the unit itself. So there's both of those going on. And I believe that we have some information here. There's about, is it 2,400?
Yeah, closer to 3,000 vouchers, portable vouchers.
Float yeah. through the city of Syracuse,
well,
generally.
Administered by the housing authority, most of which are in the city of Syracuse.
Okay.
It's a really hard number to land on because they are portable. So people, there could be people in California with Syracuse housing vouchers paying rent. Very small percentage, and I don't know the exact percentage of their total voucher population in the city, but I would guess it's up north of 90%.
So that leads in then to another question I had, and it may be tough because of the portability of the vouchers on the one hand, but I was also curious whether you could tell me outside of the city and the surrounding areas, are there projects that have been built through the low-income housing tax credit that you know of?
Yes. And that's of an issue with ours is that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about concentrated poverty
yes.
in this region. And when they talk about that, you know, we're looking at it at a region-wide scale, even beyond Onondaga County. And so I would argue that there needs to be more low-income housing projects outside the city of Syracuse, even though we, you know, support and compete with a larger, you know, all the towns and villages for these projects. The ratio needs to be a little more equitable.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Stephanie Pasquale and Paul Driscoll from the City of Syracuse's Department of Neighborhood and Business Development. Let me circle back to something else. The NPR and the Frontline reports documented a shortage of Section 8 vouchers relative to the need and the demand for them. Only 1 in 4 eligible households get them, according to that story. And then there is the challenge for the recipient in finding quality housing that accepts these vouchers. And many lose the vouchers after the 90-day period of validity expires. So the vouchers often fail to serve one of their most important purposes, which is to put people in environments of greater opportunity. How what's your sense of how that plays out in Syracuse? Do the vouchers go without placement and then expire? What happens?
I do think there are challenges, particularly with larger families, because the voucher also comes with certain guidelines. So if you had 9 children, even if you found a 2-bedroom apartment that you love, that's overcrowding. So you know it's based on family size and what's available. As I mentioned, they do the housing authority performs an inspection prior, so the property does need to pass a housing quality standards to make sure that it's safe for those families that are moving in. And we have heard anecdotally that there are some issues with finding properties that meet those guidelines, as well as having landlords that will accept that payment. I don't know if you recall, recently the city of Syracuse did pass an ordinance to protect source of income so that landlords can't discriminate based upon where you're getting your funding from. Outside of the city of Syracuse, however, if you're a landlord in the rest of Onondaga County, you don't have to accept a voucher. So there, it does place some limitations on folks who might find a property or a rental property outside of the city that meets every other check mark, but the landlord, you know, isn't interested in using the voucher.
And thinking about now going back to the low-income housing tax credit program, can you tell me more about the specific housing developments that have been built in the city and in Onondaga County more generally through it? I mean, what are they like? Where are they?
Well, they're generally the nature of a housing tax credit application is about 50 units minimum. You know, it really makes an application viable with the state. And so to put it into actual projects, I don't know if you remember the LJ issue where there was 9 apartment buildings scattered throughout the building that HUD was going to auction off, and And we managed, the city of Syracuse early on in the minor administration managed to get those buildings. There's something like 270 units in all nine of these buildings from HUD for a dollar. And most of them were rehabilitated through the housing tax credit project. So that there's two on the 600 block of James Street. There was the Huntley building on Stolp Avenue in Strathmore. It was, I think, seven of the nine received low-income housing tax credits to help the developer rehabilitate these projects. And now they're, you know, occupied and lights on at night and all is well. I'm trying to think of some other, you know, high-profile projects. The Clinton Plaza project, which is now called Royce Residence in downtown Syracuse, is a form of a tax credit project. It's kind of a RAD, they call it RAD project, which is extending the affordability of that building for another indefinite, I think, 40 years. So they're typically apartment buildings, and they're typically 50 or more units, although there are examples of scattered site throughout, you know, scattered site tax credits that are in different parts of the city in one project.
And you had mentioned, and we'll get into this later, that, you know, there needs to be more outside of the city, but you did know of a few anyway. Can you tell me a bit about those, where they are and what they're like?
Yeah, there's recently there was a project of about 50 units in Baldensville that was a tax credit project. There was one in Cicero. And again, they're just fewer and farther between. You know, there's not the number of projects or units being developed through this low-income housing tax credit program.
I think those ones you mentioned are more family housing, but some of the other ones we've heard of are for seniors that are outside of town.
Correct. So the senior ones are more outside of town. Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Paul Driscoll and Stephanie Pasquale from the Syracuse City Department of Neighborhood and Business Development about the low-income housing tax credit program and Section 8 housing vouchers. Stephanie, I wanted to continue with the low-income housing tax credit program. And one of the things that the NPR and the Frontline reports described was for the units that do exist in this program, there are very long waiting lists of lower-income people that want to rent there, especially if that housing is built in more middle-income areas. But anyway, how does that play out in the city of Syracuse? Are there these long waiting lists of people waiting to get in?
I think we hear a lot about waiting lists, particularly with the Section 8 vouchers. And I do know that the low-income housing tax credit projects, once they become online, they are leased up very quickly. Mm-hmm. There is a very, from an income standpoint, a fairly narrow window you must fit in order to qualify. So typically it's under 65% of the area median income. Mm-hmm. But you also do have to be able to afford some payment. So it's often the working poor that are eligible for those units. They require a rental payment, unlike Section 8, where it's somebody subsidizing 30% of your, you're only paying 30% of your income, but the other 70% is subsidized. So the waiting list that we hear of are particularly with the very low income, extremely low income families, that their need to have the Section 8 payment necessitates, the waiting list is at least 2 years from what we understand.
And that's tough if these vouchers expire after 90 days, right? I mean, that sort of puts you in a bind then.
Absolutely. And I know they can grant some small extensions, but typically, if you're unable to, we have a family we're working with right now that their last extension ends, June 20th, and that's it. They're going to have to return the voucher.
Now, we were talking during the break, and you had mentioned that there's another way to look at the number of units in Syracuse, and you wanted to make sure our listeners were clear on that. Go ahead.
I think we estimate there's about 1,500 or more low-income housing tax credit units that have been built in Syracuse since the program's inception, and that just of late we've had those three large projects that have had about 50 apiece.
Okay. All right. Great. Now, another problem that was described in these reports with that housing tax credit program is, and this gets into the thing that, Paul, you intimated at the beginning, but because of the political process for approving the housing projects that are built through the program, most of these housing developments that are built through the program end up being built in poor, low-opportunity neighborhoods. And in Dallas, which the reports looked at in detail, they found that 90% of the projects were built there. One of the ideas behind the program, as I understand it, is that it was going to diversify that more and mix up the housing, and that was the whole incentive to the developers of providing them the tax credit. So say more about, if you could, about how that challenge plays out in Syracuse. How do the political dynamics play out about where these things get located in the area?
Yeah, you know, I've never personally filled out a low-income housing tax credit application, but I understand from leveraging them for different companies that, you're trying to score as many points on the application as possible. And so you're trying to serve an underserved or a community that needs affordable housing. So the tendency is to find a location in more distressed neighborhoods to either rehab or build this housing. But at the same time, you know, that also leads to the concentration of poverty to a certain degree. And I think that's what occurred. You know, that's what the Supreme Court ruling on the Texas case was, is that low-income housing tax credits in that instance were concentrating poverty in that sense. So I think since that, Supreme Court ruling 2 summers ago, I think it was, the state of New York and Housing and Community Renewal, which is the state agency that oversees these credits for the state, are very conscious or more conscious of where these are located. And, you know, bring in an anecdotal point, but we're cutting a ribbon in the next week on a project, a low-income housing tax credit project in kind of the Tip Hills neighborhood. It's the Harbor Lofts on Emerson Ave. And that, to me, is the beginning to recognize that we need to provide affordable opportunities in more stable neighborhoods, but again, even beyond the city of Syracuse, that means. And so, you know, the city is one entity. There are 19 towns and 13 villages. They're all kind of separate entities, all determining whether or not they should apply for or allow a developer to apply in their town or village. And it gets a little messy.
I'm going to return to that next week. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guests are Stephanie Pasquale and Paul Driscoll. Stephanie, I think you wanted to jump in on that one just for a second, and I cut you off. Go ahead. And then I want to ask, in the few minutes that we have left, a couple other questions that come out of those investigative reports. But go ahead.
Sure. I just want to be clear that a lot of the housing partners we work with that do this work, they would love to diversify where their locations are. There are some challenges, and
yes,
Paul identified a few, particularly with how the application is structured, how they're scored, and the availability to gather site control of enough properties to do a 50 or plus unit development. So there's issues with zoning and with cost and with acquisition that sometimes preclude performing or doing these projects outside of city limits. So we're sensitive to that, but you know, we all agree. I think we all agree in the development community that more needs to be done outside of the city.
Now, one of the other things that these reports discovered were instances of kickback schemes under the low-income housing tax credit program, in which developers inflated the construction estimates that would be required to build these buildings. And then they received the tax credit based on those estimates. And then they got that extra money that was, in a sense, saved, so to speak. They got that back from the construction contractors when the units were built at a lower cost than they were originally estimated. Do you know if that's ever happened in Syracuse?
I am not aware of anything like that, Grant, but I would also say this. If you were to look at a low-income housing tax credit application, there are literally 3 phone books on top of each other. They're the most, you know, obscene, voluminous documents that you've ever seen. And to try to understand where all the money is in there, you know, in one case, we're looking, trying to understand what the developer fee for one project was that the developer would be getting. And even working with the state, it was really difficult to determine what that fee is. So I could see there's so much, because they're so complicated and touch so many different areas, there's a lot of, I would guess, a lot of room for that type of, you know, malfeasance. I don't know what you want to call it, but we've not run into that specifically in Syracuse anyway.
Well, what you just said leads directly into the last thing I wanted to ask about, and we've got just a couple minutes here to discuss it, but one of the prosecutors in the frontline program mentioned this, that because of that complexity that you just described, that most states, the regulatory agencies, just really don't have the bandwidth to spot the transgressions and to stay on top of this, and also local governments as well. He was describing it basically as a government capacity problem. And I was curious as to whether, you know, where does New York fit on this? I mean, you know, it might have been a problem in Texas or Florida, but maybe not so much a problem here. Do you have any sense of how much, in a sense, on the ball New York is in comparison with other states on this issue, either one of you?
Well, I can't speak to New York State overall. However, I just wanted to let listeners know that for projects, these low-income housing tax credits projects, where they're soliciting City of Syracuse dollars as well, we have a contract with the National Development Council, and we do seek outside support to help underwrite these applications to make sure when we do our own internal underwriting, we sort of have a double check to make sure that these projects seem appropriate, that costs seem appropriate, utility estimates seem appropriate, cost savings in the future, and what the operating pro forma looks like. So I just wanted listeners to know that we do that due diligence when it comes to requests for our own support.
Yeah, and I really can't speak to the state level capacity. I mean, we work very closely with HCR, which is that department of the state that accepts these and reviews these. But they are generally the experts on, mm-hmm. you know, it's their program, and they're assessing the applications applying to their program. So my understanding is it's very rigorous review of these applications.
Have there ever been any high-profile prosecutions in this regard that either of you can recall?
I cannot, but again, I'll speak to the point that there's so many, you know, it's so complicated, and there's so many transactions in regards to tax credits. We can't even go into it here, but there's plenty of opportunity for that, you know,
sure.
because you're syndicating these credits to bankers, and you actually hire syndicators to do it. There's just so many players involved in this financing mechanism,
and lots of lawyers, I'd imagine.
Lots of lawyers, and everyone has to get paid. So it's ripe for that type of abuse.
That was Paul Driscoll and Stephanie Pasquale. We'll continue our conversation next week, and we'll look at other programs to address the problem of quality housing for low-income and poor families in the Syracuse area. Paul, Stephanie, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.